After a brief scan of the area, the choppers resumed single-file formation and headed back in the east-southeast direction of their original approach. The jets banked, came back for another pass before heading back in the same direction as the choppers. Two ships from parts unknown had apparently landed on the ground and possibly were still there. Why call off jets and choppers right in the middle of their special task force operation? The answer would become clearer, but for the time being common sense stated that either they found nothing upon arriving at the hotspot and called back to base, or the pilots were ordered back to base whether they located and/or identified the crafts or not. At my urgent request, John and I hopped into his pickup and took to the back roads and the general area where the incredible incident had just happened. Although this was John's neighborhood, driving blindly through unfamiliar territories turned out to be a futile effort. The two were forced to give up the search and head back for home. 6. Back at the mobile home, Jim remained on the porch from where the observations had been made, anxiously awaiting any further developments. From 7:10 to 7:20 p.m., Saturday evening, December 30th until 1:50 a.m., New Year's Eve, he reports, I stood in one spot, my attention riveted out there, waiting. At 1:50 a.m. one of the craft began rising from the area that had harbored it for the best part of 6 hours, sick. The flashing red lights that circled the lone ship's outer perimeter moved faster and faster in the 6-5-4-3-2-1. 1-2-3-4-5-6 sequence as it climbed steadily above the dark terrain below. Then the ship shot straight up, paused, accelerated to a greater height until, its, outer structure transformed into a glowing white magnificent craft, which, shot straight up again, paused, then accelerated in one final ascending burst of speed, covering a vast distance. At this moment, a fiery object could be seen rising from the ground above the Atlantic Ocean. Coincidentally, a Minuteman II missile had just been launched from its underground silo at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. As if in response, the strange craft zipped to the right, then, to the left, performed a vertical Z pattern all in one continuous flowing streak of light, then, drew near the cone section of the fast-rising missile, then, streaked off to the south and vanished. 7. During Easter 1968, Jim read an article in a special edition section of the Orlando Sentinel entitled UFO Tracks Minuteman Missile Over Cape Canaveral, written by Dick Young. Unfortunately, he lost track of the newspaper. Several years later, he researched microfilm at both the Sentinel and Orlando Public Library's system main branch. The newspaper was intact, with the exception of the special edition, of course. 8. In 1968, further sightings occurred in the same general vicinity. On February 17, Jim approached an intense flashing blue light which appeared to be reflecting off the metallic surface of a disc, as well as patches of a deep glowing red. He then perceived an aerodynamic structured craft perhaps 50 to 60 feet end to end, with each end tapered down and expanded to 15 to 20 feet in height at its center. It had not occurred to me at the time that the glowing red that encircled the strange-looking sleek object might have been a force field. As I stood there just staring at the glowing aura, the hair on the back of my head literally stood on end. While the adrenaline soared through my body, I pivoted my body around and tried to walk away from the remote probe and the unknown ship, but I could not bring myself to take another step. Though shortly, I managed to force one foot in front of the other and made my way back to the car with considerable effort. It was now a little over half an hour since Jim first observed the craft. On his way home along State Road 420, he caught sight of a glowing red cigar-shaped object as it floated up from a field and glided alongside the car, paused, tilted upward, then vanished into the sky. 9. At sundown the following day, Jim's brother Gary showed up at the former's residence in Orlando, and the two drove off in Jim's car to the corner of State Road 420 and Fort Christmas Road, in search of more strange craft. We stood there for several minutes, and the FBL appeared in the same location as it had done the previous night, the flashing light reflected off the dark metallic surface, Jim reported. I pointed it out to my brother, no response. He just stood there staring at the blue light as it dropped silently below the dark tree line deep into the field and west of our location. I approached the fence, as I had the previous night, and climbed over, my brother close behind me. I began walking in the direction where the small wonder disc had just disappeared below the dark topography. Moreover, like the previous night, while relentless howling winds whipped across the field and rattled the clusters of saw palmettos, I ventured a short distance and paused, with the same feeling I had the previous night. We were being watched. My brother must have sensed something too, because he seemed ready to bolt. The men returned to the car and headed for home. Then, at around 19:35 the next day, Jim returned to the same observation post. As he passed by Lake Louise and rounded a curve, the same, or similar, flashing blue light hovered about 200 feet ahead, then paced the car along Fort Christmas Road for a mile or so. Just over a week later, as he arrived at the same observation point and at the same time as previously, 15 to 20 cattle were bellowing and running around, terrified, as a blue pulsing light hovered above. The light vanished, and moments later a jet flew fast and low over the area, then made another pass before heading away. 11. On March 4, 1968, about 200 yards southeast of the previous area, a B-52 bomber appeared above the tree line. As it headed west, a brilliant flash of light emitted from its underside, illuminating the terrain below. The bright cone-shaped lights flashed 12 times in 3 sequence increments, Jim believes. Presumably, photographs were being taken. The following night, at the same location, a car driven by a man with a woman beside him pulled up alongside Jim. The man asked Jim what he was doing out there. "Do you believe in flying saucers?" retorted Jim. The woman snickered, but the man sat there silently. I pointed in the general area where I had watched a B-50 to rise above the tree line over there, pointing, and I thought the crew had taken pictures of something on the ground. "The area you're talking about is the Canada Ranch, where I live," the man volunteered. "I'm Ben Canada," and at that moment, the Air Force B-52 appeared again above the tree line. Again, brilliant flashes of light illuminated the ground in the same sequence. Jim asked Canada if he'd been missing any cattle recently. "Come to think of it," he responded, "last week I found a young heifer, a healthy animal, standing out in the middle of the pasture. How she managed to get out of the high, well-built pen that I had her in that night was beyond my comprehension." He added that large numbers of animals had recently been unaccounted for, and that many farmers and ranchers from the area and the Street Cloud area had had meetings with the Cattlemen's Association to try and solve the problem, without success. 12. On the evening of March 20, 1968, Jim felt compelled to go outside, drawn to the front of his mobile home. A disc, roughly 2 feet in diameter, was hovering outside the living room windows. A flashing blue light emitted from a thin rod atop the disc, perhaps an eighth of an inch in circumference, 2 or 3 inches long, and positioned near the outer edge of the probe. The blue light pulsed at a slow, steady rhythmic rate, and the flashing rate reflected off the disc's dull burnished metallic surface. Suddenly, the disc shot away and out of sight, and then reappeared to the right of the cypress trees behind the trailer and headed in a northeast direction until I lost sight of it. 13. 6 days later, while visiting his parents in Orlando, Jim was struck suddenly with a bad headache and a simultaneous compulsion to leave the house. He got in his car, heading for a 7-Eleven store to get some painkillers. On returning to the car, he heard his full name called out, loud and clear, in similar vein to the communications reported by Carl Anderson, Chapter 7. A case could be made that I was hearing voices, the skeptic might say, Jim acknowledges, but I know the difference between hearing voices in my head and having my name come through in a clear audible tone. I headed east on Virginia Avenue, all the while wondering what was going on, then realized the headache had stopped. Moments later, I rolled to a stop at the Bumby Avenue and East Colonial Drive intersection, and felt compelled to look out the window and up. The remote disc hovered above the traffic signal, its signature blue light flashing with a steady rhythm. I turned right and 20 minutes later turned left onto State Road 419, and spotted the disc as it glided along above the field, and began moving slowly until it disappeared into the stand of trees that it had vanished into on March 18, 14. One of the most interesting events occurred during the night of September 15 that year. Jim, together with his mother Naomi, niece Michelle, and Bendix electrician Larry Kelly and a friend, was standing by the big metal gate at the usual observation post when an amber cone-shaped beam of light appeared 100 feet above the orange grove. I proceeded to run as fast as I could through the sandy open lane that extended north through the middle of the grove, said Jim. Moments later, Larry and his friend had caught up with me. I took off, running west over the white sandy trail. Suddenly, I stumbled headlong into a pile of cast-off tree debris, followed by Larry and his friend. By now, Jim's eyes had adjusted to the darkness. 15 yards away could be seen the faint outline of a cigar-shaped craft which blended almost seamlessly into the dark terrain. Faint phosphor-green patches of light flickered and danced around the ship's midsection. An eerie stillness permeated the immediate surroundings and a strange energy seemed to emanate from the hovering craft. I was ready to bolt, then vehicle headlights unexpectedly illuminated the darkness. The dark blue or black vehicle headed toward the craft. I turned and ran as fast as I could toward the big gate. I could hear Larry and his friend right behind me running as fast as they could to keep up with me and put as much distance behind them and what they too had observed. My mom and niece obviously sensed that something was not right and both headed for their car. Jim speculates that the dark sedan driver was most likely a government, military, or NASA official sent to rendezvous with the spacecraft in a sparsely populated nondescript dot on the map named Bithlo. During the Apollo program, the ETI, extraterrestrial intelligence, took full advantage of the perfect meeting place, situated between the back end of fenced-in orange groves, with no trespassing signs and near the shoreline of a pristine kidney-shaped body of water named Lake Pickett. After each meeting, the human officials and ET emissaries had exited the open wire gate west of the main gate, turned right, driven several miles, intersected with Highway 50, another left turn, and from there proceeded to their destination, the Cape and/or Kennedy Space Center. Whatever agreements have been made between the extraterrestrial intelligence and United States government and NASA officials, we may never know. The fact that agreements did take place is known, and surely the extraterrestrials waited and watched from a distance as the historic lunar event unfolded on July 20, 1969, as Neil Alden Armstrong and Edwin Eugene Aldrin, Jr. became the first humans to land on the moon. 15. Apollo 11. In Apollo 11, The Untold Story, a British documentary first shown in July 2006, Buzz Aldrin revealed that their spacecraft had encountered a UFO during its flight to the moon. There was something out there that was close enough to be observed, and what could it be? He began. Mike Collins decided he thought he could see it in the telescope, and when you made it real sharp, it was sort of bell-shaped. Obviously, the three of us were not going to blurt out, "Hey, Houston, we've got something moving alongside of us. Can you tell us what it is?" We weren't about to do that, because we knew that those transmissions would be heard by all sorts of people and, who knows, somebody would have demanded we turn back because of aliens, or whatever the reason. The event remains unexplained, as confirmed by Dr. David Baker, Apollo 11 senior scientist. 16. I happened to be touring the USA with the London Symphony Orchestra at the time and, together with my colleagues, sat spellbound as we watched the live transmission in Chicago. I recall hearing one of the astronauts refer at some point to a light in or near a crater during the transmission. According to an Associated Press report, the astronauts sighted strange lights inside a crater near the point where their lunar lander was due to touch down the next day. On their first orbit around the moon, Armstrong described a mysterious bright light on the inner wall of the crater Aristarchus, located north of their flight path. It seems to have a slight amount of fluorescence to it. The area in the crater is quite bright, he reported to Houston. That area is definitely brighter than anything else I can see, confirmed Aldrin. There doesn't appear to be any color involved in it. It looks like an eerie sight, 17. Two former NASA employees, Otto Binder and Morris Chake, the latter a former chief of NASA Communication Systems, confirmed that Apollo 11 encountered other landed spacecraft on the moon. These babies are huge, sir. Enormous. Mission Control was informed by the astronauts, according to Binder's sources. Oh, God, you wouldn't believe it. I'm telling you there are other spacecraft out there. Lined up on the far side of the crater edge. 18. The Soviets were the first to publicly confirm the incident. Physicist Dr. Vladimir Ajatsa, a professor of mathematics at Moscow University, stated that Neil Armstrong relayed a message to Mission Control that two large, mysterious objects were watching them after having landed near the lunar module. This and related messages were censored by NASA. Another Soviet scientist, Dr. Alexandr Kazantsev, claimed that Buzz Aldrin had taken color movie film of a spacecraft from inside the module, and continued filming them after he and Armstrong went outside. The alien craft departed shortly thereafter. 19. All the original Apollo film material is located in NASA's Film Archive, Building 8, located in the Johnson Space Center, JSC, Houston. In 1970-71, Donna Hare worked for Philco Ford, a NASA contractor, in the photo lab at Building 8 and in different areas of the company, both on and off site. On one occasion, she told Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, she entered a restricted area of the lab, she held a secret clearance, unrelated to her work with Philco Ford. A friend there directed her attention to a mosaic of photographs taken from a high altitude, possibly via satellite. In one of the photo panels I saw a round white dot, she related. And I said to him, what is that, a dot on the emulsion? And then he's grinning and says that dots on the emulsion don't leave shadows on the ground. And there was a round shadow at the correct angle with the sun shining on the trees. I was pretty startled because I had worked out there several years and had never seen anything like this. And I said, is this a UFO? And he's smiling at me and says, I can't tell you that. The man told her that photos of such objects were always airbrushed out prior to being distributed publicly. From another employee at JSC, Donna Hare learned that some of the astronauts who wanted to talk about their experiences with UFOs had been threatened and coerced into signing statements agreeing not to do so, on penalty of losing their retirement pay. One gentleman that I knew very well was in quarantine with the Apollo astronauts, following their return from the moon. He said that just about every one of them had seen things when they went to the moon. In fact, one said that craft were on the moon at the time of a landing, Apollo 11. Hare also met a security guard who claimed that one day some soldiers in fatigues had ordered him to burn a lot of UFO pictures, although forced not to look at them. He was tempted to glance at one, showing a UFO on the ground. Shortly thereafter, Hare reports, he was hit on the head with a gun butt, and he still had the scar on his forehead. 20. In Inside the Spaceships, George Adamski describes his second flight in a spaceship in 1953, during which he was shown parts of the moon. In some of these places, there was still a very small growth of vegetation perceptible, he commented. Part of the surface looked fine and powdery. 21. Which is precisely how Neil Armstrong described it during his first steps on the moon in July 1969, the surface is fine and powdery. During another flight to the moon, in August 1954, Adamski was shown, through a viewing screen, parts of the other side, featuring a temperate section which included a number of thickly timbered mountains, as well as lakes, rivers, vegetation, and even a city. 22. Though these claims were ridiculed at the time, photographs of the other side taken by Apollo 8 and 10, for example, clearly show what looks like moss, or vegetation of some sort. I purchased a large print from Hasselblad of the Schmidt crater, taken from Apollo 10, which displays a pronounced dark green surrounding the crater, itself a mixture of white, fawn, and pink colored areas. In Above Top Secret, I cited the testimony of a friend of mine who had participated in a NASA conference in Italy in June 1984, during which she learned from Neil Armstrong that other spacecraft were on the moon when they landed. At the time, I was not permitted to include either the name of my source nor many other details. However, since she passed away a number of years ago, I am now able to do so. My source was Pamela Hanford, who had served with Britain's Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. I once asked about her background in the clandestine organization, bearing in mind that I am still firmly bound by the Official Secrets Act, she explained, "All I can tell you is that I trained with the School of Military Intelligence, in those days at Maresfield Park, and did my parachute training with the London 21st. I was trained for the Russian front, learned Russian, and came under MI6's umbrella. Because of the sensitivity of the field work, I can tell you nothing more." 23. The NASA conference was held at several venues, including the Old Castle Maschio Angiono in Naples and the Europa Palace Hotel in Anacapri. Some astronauts attending were staying at the Vittoria Excelsior Hotel in Sorrento, Pamela said. Her impromptu presentation was entitled Man, an Extraterrestrial Experiment. It was only a very short stopgap, and I probably scribbled the gist of it on a piece of hotel writing paper, she explained. It so happened that Pamela's suite, room 131, adjoined that of Neil Armstrong, room 132. At one point during the conference, Pamela overheard a conversation in the next room between Armstrong and a professor, Herbert Schwartz, the gist of which went as follows. Schwartz: "What really happened out there with Apollo 11? Armstrong: "It was incredible. Of course we had always known there was a possibility. The fact is, Herb, we were warned off. There was never any question of our building a space station or a moon city." Schwartz: "How do you mean, warned off?" Armstrong: "I can't go into details, except to say that their ships were far superior to ours, both in size and technology. Boy, were they big and menacing. No, there is no question of a space station." Schwartz: "But NASA had other missions after Apollo 11. Armstrong: "Naturally, NASA was committed at that time and couldn't risk a panic on Earth. But it really was a quick trip and back again." At a cocktail party later that day, Pamela confronted Armstrong. He confirmed that the story was true but refused to go into further detail, beyond admitting that the Central Intelligence Agency was behind the cover-up. Officially, however, he denies the incident. There were no objects reported, found, or seen on Apollo 11 or any other Apollo flight other than of natural origin, he told me. 24. In 1995, I asked Pamela if she still stood by her claim. "Yes, Tim," she replied, "I still stand by the Armstrong report. Like Martin Luther, I can do no other." Perfectly placed as I was in the next suite, and in the light of the cover-up the United States still has in place, it surprises me not that Neil Armstrong denies it. Pamela added that, according to her information, since the early 1960s the States has had contact with a superior extraterrestrial planet. 25. I made four requests to NASA for details of this conference. The first person with whom I communicated politely explained that she had been unsuccessful in accessing any information. No replies were forthcoming from my additional three requests, via a different NASA inquiries website. However, my girlfriend tracked down online the proof that a conference had taken place. The Journal of Space Law for the relevant period reviews the International Symposium on Space Lab held in Naples and Capri from 11-16 June 1984, noting that the second forum was held in the Europe Palace Hotel in beautiful Anacapri and dealt with the utilization and the legal, economic aspects of space systems. Unfortunately, other than mentioning the participation of the European Space Agency, ESA, and NASA, none of the contributors is listed. 26. Thus forearmed, I sent a Freedom of Information Act request asking NASA for details of the speakers. They eventually responded by citing several library sources, one being the Canada Institute for Scientific and Technical Information, from which I purchased a copy of Earth-Oriented Applications of Space Technology, listing many of the attendees at the second forum only. 27 No mention is made of Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, Professor Herbert Schwartz, or Pamela Hanford. Space Defense, according to Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Cosso, the intelligence officer who headed the U.S. Army's Foreign Technology Division at the Pentagon. In 1961, NASA agreed to cooperate with military planners to work a second-tier space program, which was covered up by the civilian scientific missions. They agreed to open up a confidential back-channel communications link to military intelligence regarding any hostile activities conducted by the aliens against our spacecraft. What NASA didn't tell military intelligence, of course, was that they already had an even more classified back channel to former CIA director Hinko Ehtar's working group and were keeping them updated on every single alien spacecraft appearance the astronauts reported, especially during the early series of Apollo flights when the alien craft began buzzing the lunar modules on successive missions after they thrusted out of Earth orbit. Even though military intelligence was kept out of the operational loop between NASA and the working group, I and a few others still had contacts in the civilian intelligence community that kept us informed. And the Army and Air Force managed to find at least 122 photos taken by astronauts on the moon that showed some evidence of an alien presence. It was a startling find and was one of many reasons that the Reagan administration pushed so hard for the Space Defense Initiative in 1981. 28. The Honorable Paul Heyer, former Canadian Minister of Defense under Prime Minister Lester Pearson and Deputy Prime Minister Rhonda Pierre Trudeau, found Cosso's book so compelling that he decided to check its credibility with a retired American general. "Every word of it is true, and more," responded the general. "We then spent 20 minutes discussing the and more, to the extent that he could without revealing classified material," Heyer confirms in his latest book. "He told me that there had been, in fact, face-to-face discussions between the visitors and U.S. officials." 29. In 2004, President George W. Bush announced his vision for space exploration, calling for humans to return to the moon by the end of the next decade. 30 The plan was cancelled in 2010 by President Barack Obama, citing cost and danger. 31 In 2006, the Bush administration stated its intention to dominate space, rejecting any new treaties that would limit the United States' extraterrestrial activities, warning that it would oppose any nations that tried to get in its way. A policy statement signed by Bush asserted that, in its own national interests, the U.S. had the right to conduct whatever research, development, and other activities in space were deemed necessary. As journalist Andrew Buncombe commented, "When proposals to ban the weaponization of space have been put forward at the United Nations, the United States has routinely abstained." But last October, 2005, the U.S. voted against a UN resolution calling for the banning of weapons in space. 32. Gordon Cooper. In early 1978, NASA issued an information sheet by way of response to inquiries directed to the White House as well as NASA on UFOs. NASA is the focal point for answering public inquiries to the White House, it begins. NASA is not engaged in a research program involving these phenomena, nor is any other government agency. Reports of unidentified objects entering United States airspace are of interest to the military as a regular part of defense surveillance. Beyond that, the U.S. Air Force no longer investigates reports of UFO sightings. 33. In his autobiography Leap of Faith, astronaut Gordon Cooper describes the landing of a flying disc at Edwards Air Force Base on May 3, 1957. At the time, Cooper was assigned as test pilot and manager, with top secret clearance, to the Fighter Section, Experimental Flight Test Engineering Division, and he recounts that his camera crew came running in to tell him what had just occurred. "They told me they had just finished their work when the saucer flew over them, hovered over the ground, extended three landing gears, then set down about 50 yards away. They described the saucer as metallic silver in color and shaped somewhat like an inverted plate. They said they had shot images with 35mm and 4x5 still cameras, as well as motion picture film. When they had tried to approach the saucer to get a closer shot, they said it lifted up, retracted its gear, and climbed straight out of sight at a rapid rate of speed, again with no sound. They estimated the craft to be about 30 feet across,